This is the Lifetime Athlete Podcast, and today we're going to start out with a quick little story about our name, the name of the podcast, and the name of our community, the Lifetime Athlete, and how the human beast has evolved as one. This is the inspiration for TLA. A long time ago, let's say between 2 and 3 million years, the human, as all natural animals on planet Earth, was an athlete. The act of gathering, of course, had some athletic qualities, but in particular, it was the hunter who was the original athlete. While this has evolved to be more of a male role, there's strong evidence that in the early times, both genders participated in this original sport of hunting. And winning at this sport, being a champion athlete, if you will, meant surviving and thriving. Athletics were integrally tied to life or death, and the best athletes advanced the gene pool. As time passed, the role of warrior was added to that of hunter under the human athlete heading. Eventually, we began to invent games and competitions that mimicked or prepared us for the jobs of hunting and fighting. Competing in these sports was viewed as healthy, natural, and necessary. Next, we began to practice for these games, always with a focus on play and competitiveness, which really was the elemental form of training. Fast forward to today, and we live in a world where many don't view themselves as athletes. Sport and competition are not wholly embraced, and very few exercisers actually train with a purpose and a method. Fortunately, that's not you, listeners. Thanks for being here, by the way, as you are here because you embrace a lifetime of athletic pursuit. You see sports as an essential part of our culture, and you know that training effectively is how all this magic happens. And that, folks, is a true story. And effective training, creating workouts that work, is the title of this, the 133rd episode of the pod. This is John Zombro and PK, and we are your hosts on this exciting journey. Good morning, PK.
Good morning, John. Thank you for kicking that off properly.
I love telling a good story.
Yeah, well, you are good at it. That's how it goes.
I'm a student of many things, that among them.
All right. So with that that intro, that preamble, what are we going to be talking about today then?
Well, creating a killer workout is really what effective training is all about. So we're going to look at prioritizing and executing your exercises and structuring the training session to maximize stimulus and adaptation. This is obviously the thing that we're going to focus on in our discussion today. And the whole objective is to help you get more out of every workout and ultimately to crush your goals. So just backing up a tad, last week we spoke about how to personalize your training, you know, figure out where your strengths and weaknesses lie and what types of training you may want to bias or use based on your body and goals. But now we're going to dive into the nuts and bolts of putting together ideal workout and training, workout and training sessions.
I love that. So last week we talked about how to personalize it. And today we're getting into the nitty gritty about what exactly to do, what the composition of these effective sessions will look like.
Yes, there are many layers and levels, but on a global way, if we just backed up and said, okay, well, we identified what a person might want or need to work on, then of course today it's okay, well, how might you put some of those components together? You know, very general but sound principles that are, you know, rooted in the science that we have in physical preparation.
Excellent. Well, where do we get started?
We should warm up by talking about the warm-up.
Do tell.
Well, some people don't like the term, you know, there's always a debate over semantics, but whatever you want to call it, the warm-up, which I'm still fine using that term personally, it's the preparatory phase when we begin a training session, and it's the point from which we launch.
Absolutely.
So here are a few points that I would say how I like to frame a warm-up. It's a time of transitioning from rest or from just a non-training status to move towards whatever that primary focus of the session is going to be. So we know, from last week, we've decided, oh, well, I want to work on this thing, this concept, this component capacity. Well, how do I get ready to do that most effectively and safely? And of course, that's what the warm-up is. Many words come to mind that folks like to use, that a warm-up is priming the system or the body or the CNS, cueing, activating, readying. I think we all embrace those descriptors. And I like to break it down in a couple different categories. So first of all, we have physiologic changes in the body with warm-up. That includes a number of things, but most people will readily say, well, warm-up sounds like we're going to increase tissue temperature and improve the extensibility of collagen fibers. And yes, that is happening. In addition to physiologic, there's a neurologic effect. In other words, we're tuning up movement patterns and lighting up the central nervous system. So in the brain, our cerebral cortex has these motor units, and we're basically waking up and connecting and making sure that we can fire the muscles that are quote unquote wired together best. And that's a neurologic effect. And then there's also a strong psychologic effect in becoming intentional and purpose-driven. It's like, oh, this, okay, the warm-up gives you that time to get rid of any baggage that might have been in the mind and then drill down, narrow down on what needs to be emphasized in the training session. And last but not least, I'd say, a warm-up typically will go from general to specific. And, that might be a general warm-up might be wearing a sweatsuit or, walking, jogging, biking for a few minutes in many cases. It's not always indicated, but sometimes that will be too specific. And so once we get specific, now we want to start training movement patterns that are, again, specific to the sport or the goal that the athlete has at that time. And I finish out by saying a warm-up should be as brief as absolutely possible, but as long as necessary.
I like how you phrase that last bit, because that is, I think, that's a sweet spot, but it's also very specific, right? Where as brief as possible, but as long as necessary. So once you're ready, once you've gotten through the warm-up and you're feeling good to go, that means you're set, but you don't need to, it doesn't need to be over long or prescribed like that, I guess.
Yeah, I think you said it best. You know when you're ready. And so energy is finite, and we want to make sure that we're brought to that state of readiness and we've got some safety. But once there, we don't want to waste any more precious energy on a warm-up. So if it's some rote thing where it never changes and it's fairly voluminous, I'm going to say no bueno.
Right.
Well,
excuse me, John. I almost sneezed there. So yeah, I agree. I do agree. And I think that, perhaps the routine, the methodology of that, is a warm-up going to change depending on the type of workout? I'm guessing yes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be very, again, specific to the athlete, specific to the sport. And this is where I think we also want to look at personality, fairly briefly and say, well, a lot of times when I'm guiding a person or a group, whether it's in person or online through a warm-up process, I'm always talking about feel and turning it back into the self and looking for that instinctive wisdom. So there'll be some folks will say, how many should I do? And usually they're looking for a multiple of 10 because society loves that. But, I'm not trying to be a jerk, but sometimes folks get frustrated with me and I'll say, as many as it takes till you feel it, and so it might just be 7 reps or it might be 17. And a lot of people don't like to end on odd numbers and that drives them crazy. But really, that I think a warm-up should be a flow experience, and you're really just tuning in to excellence, not so much serving this extrinsic spreadsheet.
Sure, but I do have to, I'll speak on behalf of the folks out there. What if you're not sort of, I guess, if you haven't paid attention close enough, or you don't have the experience to really tune into what is enough, and maybe those cues that you're, or those feelings that you're hoping to tune into are like really quiet, they're speaking softly. What would you recommend to someone like that who might not know if they're ready or not?
Yeah, I would say on the first level, that tends to grow with experience. And so, you know, we have this thing called training age where, you know, like how many years have you been training? So that's going to, we're all going to see improvement in that kind of self-knowledge of a warm-up status. But also, I would say this is just a great opportunity to get a good coach. Maybe not work with, you don't have to work with a coach forever. I'm not suggesting that, but a coach can help you to understand, oh, okay, cue these movements, do this. Okay, do you feel that? Okay, change this. Now we can progress. And so, again, a few bits of guidance and oftentimes just key words can help a person tune into those feelings. And many of us need and benefit from that. And of course, that's why, you know, at the Lifetime Athlete, coaching for peak performance is what we're all about. We're talking about it. That's the primary service that's offered. And it is valuable. It really does help to solve that problem that you described.
No doubt. All right. So we've done a brief as possible, but it's been long enough to warm us up. What do we take it from here?
Now we have to consider those types of training about which we are often speaking here on the podcast.
Okay, let's get into it.
Never hurts to review the five major forms of training and their emphases. So I'll just kind of blow through these. Stop me if you need. There's MOSTAT, which is mobility and stability training. And that's those things we do for flexibility, for activation, postural enhancement, ingraining movement patterns, skills, and ultimately to develop agility, which is a composite ability to move fluidly and flow through space, own position, that kind of thing. Then we have LIST, or low intensity steady state training, which is, you know, our aerobic fitness, low slow cardio mojo that helps us develop endurance. Next is RAST, R-A-S-T, resistance and strength training. Obviously, we're going to build strength. We're going to hypertrophy muscles, make the gains bra. And so, again, that strength training is about strength. Up next is HURT. And obviously, you can tell I'm using these acronyms that I've kind of molded, so it's easy to say them, and they all relate to a form of training. That's the T on the end of each one.
Sure.
So high intensity repetition training is next. And, you know, that's sort of very similar to, say, any interval based means or mode. But in, you know, in the evolving world of sports science, I like to say we have an interval with that work bout, but the rest periods, they may be a little more flexible and not so fixed. That's why we use the term HIRT instead of HIIT. Anyway, that's anaerobic conditioning. It builds lactate tolerance and power, depending on how it's applied. Lastly, we have MVERT, maximum velocity extended rest training. That's sprinting, that's speed.
Yes.
So we know that the human beast is born with the capacity to have all of these things, but we certainly have to develop them and maintain them as we go through our athletic journeys. And I would say this, that most workouts are going to have two or three of these components. But probably not all five in any one session, because that tends to water down the effect of you know, the overall effect of the workout, as well as if you're trying to target one thing, you're diluting it a bit too much with all five.
I like that. Two or three feels and sounds right. All five sounds like just too much of a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. And you can say maybe it's example time. So most of the training sessions might start out with that, like MOSTAT training, you know, training for agility. So that's oftentimes a part of warm up. And then it might go into, okay, strength is our focus, or speed is our focus. So that there's two things that are there. Now, with let's say an easy endurance workout, we might have someone, they really don't even need much warm up. They just get rolling with their low intensity work, and then they finish at the end with some of this agility based, you know, flexibility, et cetera, training. Again, the examples abound, but I think everyone understands that. And it's always the case that the sport or the goal will drive what goes into that session. So a bodybuilder is generally always going to be emphasizing or weighting, placing heavy weight upon resistance and strength training. And of course, the marathoner or, you know, long distance endurance athlete in any sport is going to use a lot of low intensity steady state training. And that, you know, we know that and recognize that, but it's good to remind ourselves of it.
Got it. Well, that makes sense. And we've dived into those, you know, at a great deal over the last couple of years. So I think that avid listeners, they'll be familiar, but there are in the archives of the Lifetime Athlete great deeper information on all of those. But for today, when we're thinking about crafting effective training, especially based on what we talked about last week, personalization, personalizing it, what do you think about from here?
We've just got a few key points that we're going to hit today. And the first one, it's primacy.
I have no idea what you're talking about, so I'm eager to learn.
So when we look at those things that we just talked about, those capacities or those types of training, so, you know, the type of training delivers the capacity, and we went over that. Well, simply put what matters most first, following an adequate warm-up.
I like that. Okay, talk to me.
The parameter that you are trying or needing to develop, or the one that's the greatest demand in your sport, if that's applicable, should happen early in the workout when you are fresh and can invest most highly. Doing your most important thing when your CNS, that central nervous system, or muscle physiology is tired and or depleted won't yield as much adaptation. So we want to capture that ready body and really seize that moment.
And by body, I assume you're talking about not only the physical form, but the mental clarity that we have at the beginning of a workout, the I guess the emotional investment, all those things seem like the tank is full or more full when we start, and it all works together.
Exactly. You spin out of that warm up, and as we described it, you know, yeah, the body's warm, it's activated as far as movement patterns, it's focused mentally, cognitively. So all of those things, and we, you know, we really want to put our most targeted objective or effort there. And so here's a couple of examples. And there are many, and so if you don't like mine, ask me for a different one. But let's say we have a sprinter who's in season. You know, so I think that's clear what that means. Sure. True speed work, you know, truly working on speed. That's the invert. That's what's going to happen after warm up, because we want to capture again, especially with sprinting. It's such a CNS driven activity. You know, we don't want to have any fatigue in the system if possible, and that's working on acceleration, you know, like block starts and drive patterns, or maximum velocity or upright running. And so that's precisely how the sprinter would bias or use primacy in a workout. Now we have a football player training in the off season. Most of the position players are going to be focusing on building strength and adding some muscle mass, hypertrophy, body armor. And so they're gonna lift. You know, that's gonna be an emphasis in team sport. Now, any team sport in season, you know, games or competitions are won by the team properly executing plays. And so once we get past warm up, you know, that's what we're gonna do. We're gonna work on plays and execution, both individual aspects of that, but also how the team works. And that's gonna be important. And then lastly, let's say you have a distance runner or an endurance athlete, cyclist, skier, rower, again, keep naming. Base work or building the aerobic base could be a popular one. So that's going to be the steady state, or some threshold or interval based training that, you know, drives up to lactate tolerance or into VO2 max. Again, those are the things that those athletes need. And so that's going to be what they're going to do, you know, in terms of primacy. And not only should we make that thing the firstest, we should make it the mostest in terms of, say, like the percentage of energy or time that we're putting into our training session. It should be on the big rock.
You know, John, this is a lot of thoughts are zipping around my head based on this. I don't know if most of us do this when we're training. Either we're following kind of an outline or a process that we have in the past, or we're doing, let me rephrase, in work and in life, sometimes the most vital things are not the most fun or pleasant, or in some cases, the most vital are the most difficult to do. So I don't know, if I look back at my training, I don't think that I've really employed primacy and have done the most important things first. In fact, I think maybe I've like put those off, even though subconsciously I knew they were the most important.
I think that's not uncommon at all, the way you describe it. And I think it comes back to the role of coaching. So one of the golden nuggets of coaching is to help, you know, an athlete, and again, can be self-coached, or, you know, coached by a pro, figure this out. And then suddenly training becomes more effective. That's the topic of today. We're getting more out of it and ultimately achieving goals, having fun, having success, feeling great about it. And so definitely not a character issue at all. It's just more an inadvertent thing where, you know, folks will fall into traps, and they oftentimes just don't know that they could be doing things a little differently and perhaps should.
Yeah. And I think about a work day, right? Where you may, you know, like, let's say in my work, let's say I need to really write some copy or something like that, where I need to focus, I need to be creative and have energy. I might even actually on the front of my mind know that doing that first is the right thing to do for energy, the most effective, but I might just get in and check my email and do some other tasks because I know that the hard, heavy lifting that I have to do moving those words around might be difficult, so I put it off. But it's interesting to think about that applied to training. I had not thought about it exactly like that before.
Yeah, you opened up a really interesting can of worms there. And
sorry.
No, but I think there's a really key point. All the research that we have out in, say, organizational productivity and business development, and it all gets around the block chunking of work, focus, the minimization of multitasking, and the very same things exist in training. In fact, a lot of that business stuff has been borrowed from the sports world. So, you know, we have certainly a crossover effect. And the last thing I would say is we've talked about it on the show. I won't go too far now, but there are key times of the day for those things, key times of day to train. And also, you know, just when you look at the research on, say, cognitive output, I have found that there are definitely two times a day where I'm better being creative. And then as far as being administrative and structured, there's a time for that for me. And I think most of us actually are aware of that we have these things. And so any time you can make your day, you know, not only have those components that we've been talking about with primacy, but also the timing of it, even better.
I like it. Well, I'm interested to learn more about this, and I think that we could explore this. I'm just interested to learn more about primacy. I am assuming that that you have a way to follow this up in a workout. So we do the most important thing firstest, and with the mostest, what do we do from here?
Now we talk about the other side of the coin from primacy, again, working towards effective training. It is recency.
School me.
Your brain and body remember best what you did last, or in other words, most recently in terms of time. And that's the same is true for cognitive learning as well as motor learning and skill development.
Interesting.
So when we think about recency, really what we're talking about is getting towards the end of the workout and wanting to make the workout more effective. This is the place to work on a secondary component, particularly if that involves refining a motor skill or even doing like some mental aspects of conditioning, where sometimes there's a benefit to a little bit of fatigue in the system when we're trying to train certain things.
Okay. Can you, I'm sure you're going to just make it vivid with examples from different areas.
Yeah. And I'll try to use a couple more, maybe some similar, some different. So if I go back to the sprinter, again, it does depend on the time of the year, but let's just say that we've still got that person who's in season. And so they were, you know, they're out, generally out on the track, they go through warm up and then they're working on speed elements. There may be additional things that happen, but ultimately they're probably going to filter into the weight room. And so strength training it's a valuable secondary component in much of athletics, but it is very true for sprinters and for force development. Obviously, there's a lot of interpretations on that and how we do it, but yeah, you might see a sprinter using recency to build or maintain some strength. Now, let's say we got a basketball player. So as far as organizing a basketball team workout, it's pretty cool to look at what the science says. And so running lines or doing, you know, quote unquote suicide drills for conditioning, that's not a bad thing to put in at the end of a workout. But one of the things we have to remember, and I know, like, you know, it's not true across all disciplines, and I'm talking high school, college, and even professional, we need to keep the reps fairly short and the rests reasonable with that type of training, because otherwise it turns into a marathon shuffle, and that's not sport specific and can even break athletes down or negatively impact their attitude. So again, how we do that line running matters, and how the whistle is blown. Or maybe we're going to work on skills and shoot free throws, or do both together, which now starts to get slightly more game specific, because now we've got a person who's out of breath and a little tired having to shoot a free throw. And so again, we're making that training, you know, very, you know, applicable, transferable. And, you know, we used primacy to probably work on plays and more explosive things. Now we're using recency to tune up other aspects. Probably enough said there. Swimming. Well, dry land training, you know, swimmers get out of the pool, which is primary for them. And then they'll do some things, not every day, but depends on the program. Dry land training, gym work, and some of that's unique to swimming as far as how they go about it. The runner. Okay, so now let's take that distance runner again, and let's talk about the application of sprinting or fast running for him or her. The end of the workout's a great place to do what are called strides or cut downs. So they're short, moderate sprints or acceleration type runs, not really for true speed development. So we're not training them. A distance runner, if we take them when they're super fresh and we do a ton of speed development, again, there may be a place for that in their training to enhance mechanics, et cetera, but their sport demands endurance. That's the primary goal. So the secondary goal is speed. But here's the thing, if we condition that athlete to be able to switch gears and switch form and mechanics and run fast when tired, like at the end of a workout, that actually mimics what we're asking them to do at the end of a race with a kick.
I really like that example, because you can see, it's very tangible to just see that distance runner practicing kicking at the end when they're tired. And so you're getting reps at something that's going to be vitally important. So not only are you training to actually practice, but you're also learning that you can do it again and again. So it becomes, just like you said, you're really you're doing two things there. Physically you're learning, but also mentally you're seeing that it is capable and that it can be done again and again.
Yeah, a couple more thoughts on that. You know, people would say, well, if you took 0.2 of a second off of a distance runner's 100, which, you know, you can do that with training. Well, what impact is that going to have on their overall race performance? Probably not much, because we have to have that maximally developed aerobic system to get them within 100 yards of the finish line to then use their opponent's destroying kick. And so we always want to think about primacy and recency and what we're biasing to develop. So that's another, you know, a good way of thinking about it. The other thing you kind of talked about was this whole mental thing. I've worked with a lot of people who have just been self-defeatist, you know, and they're like, I can't speed up at the end of the race. And, you know, I just don't, and I can't. And I say, yeah, you know, I see that, but you can actually. Most people, you know, again, it varies from person to person. I respect individual physiology, but if we can start believing and training that, you know, it's a switch that you flip, it works. And that's why I talk about, well, you know, there's the mental thing, believing you can go harder. There's more in there, yes. But also, if a runner has not trained that ability to switch to sprinting mechanics, get up on the balls of their feet, you know, and really switch the arms and legs, well, they'll try to speed up gradually by using their same slower, you know, getting near the finish line from the start to the finish line form. And they're just pressing up against a gear where if you, no matter how much gas you give it, you're not going to go much faster. But if they switch that mechanics, it's like you downshifting your muscle car. And all of a sudden, you know, you've got 400 horse, you know, hitting the tranny and away you go.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Just like Vin Diesel out there with that, that old American steel. I like that example a lot. And it's really, I don't know, the idea of a sprinter changing those mechanics, I'm sorry, a distance runner changing mechanics and employing sprinting mechanics, that's a physical manifestation that's practicing the form. But then the act of doing it when we're training is, you know, giving confidence that it's not only possible, but it's something that they really have a deep well of. I like that example a lot. That's really, it's really tangible to see that happen and really be effective for that distance runner.
Yeah, and I'd even carry it out. I'll finish on this point, but you know, the functional human, you know, the lifetime athlete, the beast, needs to be able. Every sport, every person needs to be able to walk, jog, run, sprint, jump, land, lunge, cut. Yeah, these are just basic things, and so they should be practiced. And movement is a skill; it's an art form to be practiced.
Absolutely. So what are we doing here? We've got a workout. We've done the most important things, primacy. We've done some recency. And now what are we doing?
Well, now we get to the cool down. It probably makes sense. Warm up, cool down. Again, terms, whatever. I still think these terms make sense to most people, so I still use them. Think of it as the exit interview.
Ooh, okay.
So, you know, we've done all this training, you know, the major work is done. And if we used primacy and recency, probably created a fairly good training program. Now we need to bring the body back down toward rest. The sooner we can return it to that parasympathetic nervous system state, the sooner the gains and recovery start happening.
I like that.
So cool down, bring it down, calm it down. Yes. Now, what might we do? Well, I think here's the most important thing to do is do some brief, light mobility work, probably with active movements, you know, best. Again, you know, that might be various dynamic stretches or drills, a few things. I'm only talking a few minutes of this. That's really good. What this really provides, though, it's a chance to do a systems check, a BOD check, and assess any tight spots. You know, how was the body initially impacted by the training? You know, okay, how'd that go? What might I need to keep in mind for future? Quite valuable. That's one of the things with the cool down, have that focus. But here's the other side of this. We won't know the full extent of how that training impacted the body until the next morning. And that's due to jacked up hormones, because a lot of these workouts will use some amount of sympathetic nervous system activation. So we've got elevated levels of dopamine and norepinephrine, cortisol. And so that will mask some symptoms. So, you know, it's got to be aware of that. That's all I'm saying. And then here's where I don't even think this is a controversial statement anymore, but static stretching is actually one of the most overrated wastes of time in training.
Interesting. So you're talking about you're done with the workout and just the like stretching the hammies.
Yeah, you know, research shows doesn't really give you much, you know, poor return on investment. But and it's a big but. It often gives running through some static stretches gives the time to do the stuff we talked about before. So it gives you a chance to, you know, just kind of calm down and get into your body and let the breathing and the heart rate come down. Yes. And it's also a chance to convene or converse with coach and team. So this is good. So here's an interesting thing. It's not the stretching. It's the chance for self-reflection or fellowship it provides. So I almost always include static stretching at the end of my workouts, not because I believe it's super valuable, but it in and of itself, but it does give you an avenue into these other goals.
I love it. It's just kind of like the reflection, the meditation, the process of it all is the that's the secret sauce, not the hammy stretch. That's good stuff. That's a nugget right there. That is a training nug delivered by Coach Jeezy.
Yeah, thanks.
You bet. All right, so tie it all together, my friend, as we you know, as we are perhaps in the final stretch, the cool down of this episode. What are we thinking about tying it all together here?
Oh man, I am loving this. And I hope, guys, thanks for being with us and for listening. You're kind of seeing how this all fits together. You know, we spent some time last week on figuring out how to personalize and target things. Now today we're talking about how to put them together. There's more cool stuff coming up, but really all the stuff that we just talked about brings up the topic of fitness maker workouts versus fillers.
Yes. Okay. What do you mean by fitness maker versus a filler?
Yeah, so that's what I think we just did a decent job of describing, this kind of structured workout with primacy and recency. It was a focus session with a strong stimulus to drive adaptation. But most of us can't do this every day, or at least can't do the same thing every day and expect, you know, to have the best results, both in terms of health or performance. So filler is recovery training. It's what we put in the interims, and we do this until we're ready to do the next fitness maker. So usually all a filler session is, or recovery session, is shorter, easier training, oftentimes has lots of mobility work or low intensity cardio. It depends on the sport and the athlete, but we can put things in that don't overtax and that actually help to facilitate circulation and recovery and tissue repair and movement pattern ingraining.
I like that. I like that. And they work together for sure.
Yeah. And so that's where I think a lot of times there's a motivated person who want to be view themselves as weak or lazy, and they're really eager. And so they'll sometimes do a good workout, a fitness maker, and then think they need to come back the next day or maybe even the one after and do another. And oftentimes I'm saying, let's not, you know, let's look at the data that we're collecting and push that out a little further. There's plenty of things we can work on and do. So I'm not saying don't do anything, just do the right thing, the smart thing. And then when it's time to crush, we get a big crush and a great effect.
I like it.
So as long as the workout's not excessive, high intensity training can also be done frequently in there. You know, we can use that in recovery training to cue the system if duration is kept low. So again, depends on the athlete and the sport. What's your inner beast? What's your nature, your neurotype? Again, all things that we've discussed here. This has to do with how fast you recover and repair tissue overall, how much reactive oxygen species your body produces in relationship to workouts, the rate at which you can produce and degrade neurotransmitters. There's a lot of cool things, but for some athletes, we can get a better response instead of, say, just having them do like easy cardio and stretching, which works for a lot of folks. These other folks, we might take them through a warm-up and then have them do just a few plyometrics or short sprints, but get out of there before they start to get, you know, fatigue factors. Again, it's variable, but it's cool to know that you know, we have to create these recipes that properly cook the beast.
Yes, indeed. Well said.
So I started with a story. I'd like to end with a story with your permission.
Please do.
I've got a lot of athletes with whom we find the right kinds of workouts. And then what the right spacing is between the fitness makers and also what we do with the recovery sessions. So I've got a triathlete, who is, I think he's got a lot of warrior genes, to say it that way. He tolerates volume, like crazy. He can handle a lot of training, which is not uncommon for triathletes, by the way. But with him, we've got to watch intensity. You know, that's kind of like a second tier item for him. And so it can be like kryptonite if we're not careful in how we create or sculpt his primacy and recency issues within his effective fitness maker workouts. So that's just kind of an example. I've got a runner who she's very talented. But she doesn't do well with volume. So it's the opposite. You know, volume for her, it just starts to lead to kind of like a subtle chronic fatigue and a flatness, staleness, and suddenly the key performance indicators are just not getting hit. So with this athlete, I can use more frequent intensity if it's reasonable, but I have to keep the volume down. And again, we learned this through the coaching relationship, and then also, you know, the data sharing that we use. You know, I have a system, which we're going to talk about next week, in fact, that enables us to identify these things, these needs, and learn. And then maybe lastly, got a basketball player who he does best not with high overall volume and not necessarily with super high intensity, but with very long duration workouts. So he seems to really do well with a couple hour session, which, you know, isn't the most common thing, but then needs very minimal stuff in between for a few days. And then that helps him to reach his highest fitness. We've tried it other ways, didn't work as well. So again, every athlete, every sport, there's a chance for tweaking and tuning to get more.
Absolutely. And I like those three different examples. You have worked with these athletes over the long haul, and you've come to learn through intelligent hypothesis, trial and error, what works best. So you can start out with some speculation and try some things, but ultimately it's going to be tuning in, paying attention, and then tweaking to get to where you just described for those three different athletes.
Yeah, I try to come into it, you know, always humble and respectful, beginner's mindset, growth mindset, those kinds of things. And a lot of times say, well, okay, what's the goal? What are you trying to do? Well, what have you done in the past? What kind of program were you in? What worked for you? What do you think didn't work for you so well? And a lot of times I can figure some things out. So like, not with everyone, but with that runner, she came out of a collegiate program, which was a high volume, high mileage program, which is not uncommon. And I'm not being in a derogatory fashion talking about her. She never even beat her high school PRs, training hard for 4 years. That's not an uncommon story either, believe it or not. And a lot of these, you know, folks get crapped out the back from programs. But we kind of just figured it out, did some basic, simple tests, looked at a few things, and, oh, okay, well, you know, these are your gifts, your strengths, your talents. These are the things we want to emphasize in training on the path to the goal that you decide. And so that, you know, that's how it all happens. And I would say this, if you know your sports science, you know your inner beast to some extent, then you can make your workouts super effective, which was the topic of today. If you need help, hey, Coach Jay-Z at the Lifetime Athlete, just click on coaching, and this is what I do, and I love seeing people succeed. I like succeeding myself. Kicking ass is fun, and I think that's most of what I wanted to say about this very deep topic. We only covered it superficially today, but hopefully, as you said, PK, there was a nugget or two or a pearl that, you know, anyone can take and immediately start getting more out of their workouts.
Absolutely. Several pearls.
Well, in closing, I would say merch. Get yourself some Lifetime Athlete merchandise. Click on the shop menu item, and TLA products will be your choice for cool and actually cool as in terms of wicking fabrics. Some of those are available. Tanks, tops, tees, socks, hats, cups, water bottles, you name it. There's a lot of great stuff out there that helps you to be show your pride and membership in the Lifetime Athlete Tribe. And it certainly helps to support this podcast.
Absolutely.
And last but not least, if you are liking this show, well, we love you. And how about leaving us a rating and review wherever you listen to the show? That really does help. And we thank you if you can do that in advance.
You bet. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Bye-bye.